Very good. So what usually happens the first night? We've only got a few questions. By the end of the retreat, the box is overflowing with questions. But the first question first. Dear Ajahn Brahm, caring. How much caring is enough? When we continuously care, but still people we care suffer, and our caring isn't helping over years. Should we stop? It is frustrating to see people suffer in spite of our caring, which in turn is causing us hurt. What should we do, please? So remember, there was the story of, many of you may remember this one, of the seven monks meditating in the cave. How many of you remember the seven monks meditating in the cave story? Only maybe half of you. So those who remember, who were the seven monks? Number one was? Head monk, yeah. Number two? Brother. Number three? His best friend. No, not yet. Best friend. Number four? No, the enemy. Number five? The old one. Number six? And number seven was? Useless one. So those seven monks are meditating in a cave, and they're just meditating, may all beings be happy and well. May all beings be free of suffering, just loving kindness, having a wonderful time. And then these really bad people, they came and they found that cave. They wanted to take it over as their hideout, as a place where they could store all of their stolen goods, the place where they could hide from the police until the heat went down. And it was a beautiful cave, but the problem was the monks had found it first. And those monks, if they let them go, they'd go and tell the police. So what should the bad people, the bandits, do? They decided, kill all the monks. Slaughter them. Really bad, mean, terrible bandits. They wanted to kill all the monks. But the head monk, who was, you know, a bit fat, was also very wise, as fat monks usually are. Is that true? True. Anyway, Ajahn Chah was fat. Oh, yeah. Ajahn Gunha? You met going to see Ajahn Gunha? Yeah. Is he fat? Yes, yeah, see, there we go. Proof. And even Ajahn Sujata, he's putting on weight now. He is. Have a look. Yeah. So, no, Hasapanya, I mean, she's got a little bit to go. Her wisdom is increasing, but she still needs to put a bit more. Anyway, let's go back. So, the head monk, he was such a really wise, good talker. And he managed to convince them, these bandits. He said, look, we won't tell where this cave is. Just let us go. They said, no. No, you'll tell. And so they came to a compromise, a deal. And the deal was that the head of the bandits would kill one of the monks. We'll kill that monk in front of all the rest to show that they were serious. To show that if they let all the other monks go, but one would have to die in front of the others, just to prove that they were serious, and to show what would happen to any monk, actually all of the monks, if one of them, just one of them, told the police where the hideout was. And that's all he could do. The best deal. So the head monk had to choose who would die so all the rest could go free. Now, for those who haven't heard this story before, pay attention. Because I'm going to ask you, if you were that head monk and you had to make the choice, who would you choose so that the rest could go free? Now I would repeat again, the seven monks. The first monk was the head monk, the second was his brother who would do anything for him. Same like an old friend. A friend would sacrifice their life for you. I mean, many of you are friends, aren't you? Would you sacrifice your life for me? Maybe. Maybe not. But this was a monk, his best friend. I would do anything for the head monk. And the fourth monk was the enemy. Even though there are monks together, you know what it's like? Just some people just don't get on together. And just, you know, even though, you know, some people like curry, and some people like, what else can you like? You like mashed potato. Actually, can you get mashed potato and curry? But anyway, some things they just don't mix, I'm trying to say. So anyway, these two, they just didn't get on together at all. So, and the next one, so maybe it's an opportunity to get some peace and harmony in the cave. But the fourth monk was the enemy. The fifth monk, he was so old. You know, being a monk, you have to go to do funeral services. And then sometimes you go to the crematorium and you see some of these old people who go there because, you know, their friends are dying off. And sometimes you look and they're so old, you wonder, you know, might as well stay here. Not much point going home. It's so old. So anyway, this is really old monk. He's going to die any day, maybe a week or 2 weeks, I don't know. But same with the sick monk. The sick monk was so old. And he's about to die anyway. And last but not least, the useless monk. This monk, every time he did meditation, fell fast. We don't mind people sleeping when they meditate, but snoring as well. Really loudly, like an elephant. Now, people do snore. I remember this time I was teaching in a prison. It was a high-security prison. So I had to have a prison officer with me at all times. It was dangerous. And so, when I had a little class of meditators, a prison officer had to be with me, sitting next to me. And then I led the meditation, close the eyes, relax the body, you know, what the guided meditations. And I'd only got into, you know, just and then just relax, be peace. And I heard somebody snoring. You know who was snoring? The prison guard. He fell fast asleep. And it was lucky I opened my eyes. And one of the prisoners, his hand was almost on the keys. And I remember this prisoner, the prison officer hadn't woken up yet, and this prisoner was looking at me. He'd almost got the keys, and I opened my eyes. He's just really disappointed. Anyway, so there we go. That's the useless monk. Never did. Whenever he chanted, you know, so choice chanted out of key. And never knew the right words to chant. It's hopeless. So it's the useless monk, but he was there anyway. And I always say that every monastery has one, a useless. And same with non-monasteries as well, the useless nun. You could ask us a partnership. But no, that there's the seven monks, so he had to choose. So if you were the head monk, who would you choose? Now, I'm not going to mess around or playing around enough already. Most people would say, if you hadn't heard the story before, you sacrificed yourself. So I said, head monk, he gave himself up. And that was the wrong answer. I like telling that story because it was especially in interfaith conferences. I remember doing this talk over in Sacramento years ago, and there was an Episcopalian bishop came along. And so I thought, I'll take my chance here, and I gave him a simile, because I knew, because this is how you're taught in the Christian church, sacrifice yourself. So I said, and he said, well, sort of, what would you think, Bishop? And the bishop, if that was me, I was the head monk, I would give myself up. I sacrifice myself. I don't know why this is the case. I always think, maybe it's a bit mean-spirited. I said, no, wrong answer. And I said, don't you remember in your Bible, didn't Jesus say that to love your neighbor as yourself, which means to love yourself as your neighbor? No more, no less. So the answer was, the head monk's care and kindness for his brother was exactly the same, no more, no less, than his love and care for his best friend, for his enemy, for his the old monk, the sick monk, and the dear old useless monk. And he loved himself and cared for himself no more, no less, than all the other monks in that cave. So he said, I can't choose. It's impossible. And there's a wonderful little answer there. So here, how much should we care for these other people? The point was, you should care for yourself as well. You're involved. You're one of those monks. To love and care for yourself no more, no less than all the other people you care and love for. And that was the answer. And of course, before you remind me tomorrow or put your hand up, people always ask, but, what happened next? When the head monk said, well, I cannot choose. And this is, it's based, but very, very loosely, on the story of Taraputa Thera in the Theragata. Not quite the same, but, it's similar. And the head monk, when he heard, the thief, the head of the thieves, when he heard the explanation why this head monk couldn't choose, he was so inspired and impressed that not only did he let all the monks go free, but he became a monk himself. And half the bandits became monks, and the other half went to the village to get proper jobs. And that actually was the ending of the story of Taraputa Thera in the Theragata. He got captured by bandits. They wanted to kill him. He didn't mind. And then they said, how can you do this? Never seen anybody, actually no fear of death. I love everybody equally. And when they heard that, they were just so inspired. There's something really important going on there. So they became monks, and the other bandits went back and got proper jobs. A lot of times that's what happens, inspiration. When people get very inspired, literally inspired, a lot of the bad stuff which they've done in the past, they just let it go and become much better people afterwards. So anyway, that's how much you should care. Exactly the same as you care for yourself. No more, no less. Dear Ajahn, is the breath sensation a human being's most intimate friend? So that if a man or woman feels desire for the opposite gender, then they can remember they already have their most intimate friend in the breath sensation. I suppose so. Never heard that one before. But anyway, if a man or woman feels desire for the opposite gender, they can just remember they already have their most best friend. It's a breath sensation. It's, why do people just, have things like lust anyway? And a lot of times, it's because, they always think, this is the one for me. This is the person made in heaven for me. At last, They've arrived, and we'll live happy ever after. But life is very different to Walt Disney. Because recently they had, and oh, lots of people think, oh, isn't this wonderful? Doesn't she look beautiful? Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, they got married. Oh, just look at the way they gazed into each other's eyes. Oh, this was the closest you could get to Cinderella, you know, she actually got a poor part of, was it Los Angeles or San Francisco where she was born? And anyway, she married her prince. And they went off in a beautiful gilded carriage to Westminster Abbey or somewhere, where now they're supposed to live happily ever after. We haven't got the latest update. But I think that they ride into the sunset, but then afterwards, the dawn comes up and there's more stuff to do. But anyway, we like to think and feel, oh, just these wonderful things. But sometimes a monk, you know, if ever you want to get romantic or hear romantic stories, do not invite me. It was this monk some years ago. He was a really senior monk in Thailand, and he was invited to do this blessing service for, I think, four of the king's daughters. This is a true story. And who were marrying princes. This was in Bangkok years ago. And he gave such an incredible, wonderful Dhamma teaching that, you guessed it, the four princes ordained, and the nuns, they also became nuns. The brides. And the king never invited that monk into the palace again. Not what we wanted. We were supposed to be celebrating marriage. I need kids and grandkids to carry on the royal line, and you monks come in there and just, well, we go. So, you all know the story of the reality, the three rings of marriage. It's true, isn't it? It's amazing that sometimes that, you know, say these things. Those of you who've had a marriage and you made it last, congratulations. That's a wonderful thing you've done. You managed to get on with each other. But, you know, it's not that easy. Just, you know, living with another person, different desires, different ways of doing things. And, you know, sometimes that, what is it? Somebody said something quite wise the other day that, you know, when you do fall in love, you think you can sort of, yeah, your partner's got a few quirks in them, you think you can, you know, get rid of those, they're a pretty good person. And after a while, after 20, 30 years of marriage, you realize you're not going to change him. You're not going to change her. And then when you stop trying to change one another, instead you're caring for one another, then you have this beautiful friendship and acceptance, partnership, almost like Kalyanamitta, they say. Really, really good friends. You've been with one another for such a long time, you know each other, and, you know, you're at peace with one another. Not the sexual thing or the romantic thing, but just your best friend. And that's really good when that happens. So, but your breath the most intimate friend? Well, yeah, I suppose so, but, you know, you can't divorce your breath. If you divorce your breath, then you're in big trouble. But one of the wonderful things is not just the breath, but, you know, you. If you can be at peace with yourself, kind with yourself, accept yourself. And because with a marriage, yeah, I mean, you can just take time out. You can go overseas and play golf or go shopping or whatever it is to get away from him or her for a little while, just to get a bit of space. But you, there's no place you can go. Many of you have come a long way from Hong Kong, from India, from Indonesia, from many other places people have come on this retreat, but you're taking you with you. Wherever you go, there you are. It's weird, you know, I go travel so many countries, when I wake up, I'm there again. In fact, no, these days I say, well, I don't travel anymore. I just sit in the airplane, and the aircraft does the moving. I just sit there. It's a different perspective. You don't go anywhere. You just sit there. You look through the window, and the window changes, whatever. But, you know, you don't change. Same, wherever you go. So anyway, if you really want an intimate friend, the best one is yourself. Even if you're married, you wake up in the morning, who's the first person you see? Even if there's, you know, your partner is laying right next to you, you're the first person you see when you wake up in the morning. And I've been doing this for a long time. When I wake up in the morning, you know what I do? Good morning, me. Nice to see you again. Or words to that effect. Have a wonderful day. And when I go to bed, what do? Good night, Ajahn Brahm. You work really hard. Yeah, have a nice sleep. You know, it actually does change things. It's like a loving kindness. But, you know, towards remembering that I count too. If I have a nice night's sleep, get up in the morning and give nice talks. But, you know, that's why in my cave over the road, I always sleep on the floor. Because if you sleep on the floor, there's no way that you're going to wake up on the wrong side of the bed. There is no side of the bed. It's on the floor. So anyway, but still the breath. When I said make friends with the breath, later on when we do the breath meditation, I always encourage you to look at your breath like a friend. Look at everything like a friend. I look at my body like a friend. You know, me and my body, we've still got a few more years. We've got to hang out together. And imagine if you didn't get on together. You and your body. You hated your body. That's where people start harming their body. Or if it's not just through physical harm with razors and stuff, it's just with destroying their body with addictions to drugs or alcohol, or sometimes, you know, gambling. Anything to escape, because they've got this terrible relationship with themselves and they can't just run away, so they have all these other very destructive ways of trying to escape from themselves. It never works. So even suicide, if you think you can escape through suicide, you know what happens? Yeah, well, even before you're born again, you're a ghost. Oh, I'm back again. I didn't expect this. I'm trying to escape from you. No, I'm here again with you. So it's not a very good idea. So the most important person to have as a friend is your own body and mind. Be kind to yourself. And that you can't care for that enough. Care, care, care. And that will always respond. Other people, even other people, you know, sometimes they don't say they respond. They don't say thank you. But they always mean it. And after a while, you know, when you really are kind to other people, and then sometimes say, oh, didn't you understand? I did mean thank you. I did really thank you for being you. So sometimes it's nice to say that to people, you know, just how much you appreciate one another, but also how much you appreciate yourself. So look after yourself, care for yourself. Next question. What is the difference between five aggregates and five clinging aggregates? Thank you. One is, do you watch Star Trek? One is Klingon aggregates, the Klingons. Is that what you said? Clinging aggregates? Okay. No. All it means is looking at. That's why one of my phrases, you know, was because I used to watch Star Wars. And it still goes on, apparently. Not Star Wars, Star Trek. I've seen Star Wars. Except I know in Star Wars there's this big hairy guy. What's that? Wookie? Yeah. I know that, Wookie. Because he was the one who did a lot of internet work. He invented Wikipedia. shall I? Wookiee Peter, Wookiee Leaks? No? It wasn't him. Oh, I thought it was, that's where he got the name from. Wookiee Leaks and Wookiepedia. Oh, well, you learn something new every day. Anyway, what is it? Five aggregates affect two biofilm. Like the five aggregates, we'll mention that later on. Mentioned it very briefly. The five aggregates the five aggregates are five components of existence, I call them. The body, this stuff, and the experience, and then the perception, how you interpret the experience, the will, people call it the volitional formations, sankhara, and lastly the consciousnesses. Now, the way that the clinging comes in, it's not clinging, I prefer the word, as you'll find out soon, fuel. Yeah, the word in Pali is upadana. It literally means taking up. The word upa is exactly the same as the English word, up. And the adana, adina adana, veramani, sikkhapadang samadhiyami, the second precept of the five precepts. Adana means taking. Taking up. And that's what actually your fuel does. It sucks up the electricity. It sucks up the gas in your car. It sucks up the fuel. It takes it up. So it's not so much clinging. Clinging is not the best translation. But fuel, uptake, that is a much better word. And what it means is these five aggregates now, the body and the mind, what you experience right now, what you take to be you, that is the fuel. It takes itself up to create the next moment, which is a fuel for the next moment, like a fire which is self-sustaining, always burning. So that is like the five aggregates. They are the fuel, and they also create the next part of the fuel. That's why it keeps on going round and round and round. But you will come on that when we get to that part in the word of the Buddha. Now, Ajahn Brahm, if rebirth is suffering, according to the suttas, what is the alternative? Are we all doomed to lives of suffering indefinitely? Some of you. But those who know the way out, first of all, is to realize it's suffering. A lot of, what are you talking about? You monks, you should get a life. Life is, oh, you get some suffering, but without the suffering, there would not be the wonderful joy of achievement. Yeah, it's suffering giving birth to a kid, but then when you hold that little bub in your hands and it's now born, oh, so much joy. It was worth it, people say. Or they say, well, some people say that. Or they say, it's just like the suffering. It's cold and rainy today. But when the cold and rain passes, the rain is there to make the wonderful waterfalls and to make the gardens nice and green and all the wonderful flowers and the birds flitting through the trees, chasing the beautiful little butterflies and the little bees as they make honey and they fertilize everything and pollinate everything. And oh, it's lovely to see life alive and beautiful afterwards. Yes, but you ask those birds. And they're all chasing each other, not with play, they're trying to kill each other. And eat the butterflies. And the birds will sting you in their very sensitive areas if you get too close. And the magpies will swoop. And those birds, they, have you seen the parrots over in Bodhinyana Monastery? Sometimes they take these nuts from the tree. And I don't know why they do this. I mean, they must be on purpose. They try and drop it on your head. They do. So, oh, look at what happened today. Isn't it life wonderful? That it was on one of the what's it called, the microwave. There was a cockroach. It was actually between the glass in the front of the microwave. He was just showing off. Look at me. So, be careful tomorrow. What's in the curry? It may not be like a raisin or a date or a plum or anything. Be a little bit careful. It could be... in the microwave. So anyway, rebirth, well, what's the alternative? I would doom to lives of suffering. No. There is a way out. That's the whole point of the Buddha. He found a way out. You know what that way out is called? Eightfold Path. I did this story some time ago. There was this fellow in prison. And his name was Mo. Moha. Which is actually, in Thai that means like anger, but it really means Moha, means like delusion. So Mo was in jail. And the jail had these five really tall walls. And he couldn't see over those walls. And those five walls were the five senses. Sight, hearing, smell, taste and touch. And he had a prison guard who would never let him rest or be still. And the prison guard was called Will. And Will would always be telling Mo what to do. But after a while, Mo got used to jail. In fact, you know, it wasn't such a bad place. If he behaved, you know, he could actually go out and actually met a nice little female prisoner. And they had a little family in jail. And because he worked hard, he actually moved up in the jail hierarchy and got a nice little apartment within jail for his family. And life was pretty good, he thought. Because he was born in jail, lived all his life in jail, that's all he knew, was jail. And he thought that's all there was. But one day he was in his cell alone and he realized he was actually one of the floorboards was loose. And he picked it up and took it off and there was a tunnel inside. And the tunnel was called Arya Atangikamaga. He didn't know what it meant, but it sounded cool. Party for Eightfold Path. Unfortunately, he had a guidebook there. And he looked at the guidebook, and it was called Sutta Pitaka. Didn't know really what it was, but interesting. And he saw it was written by this person, Sakyamuni. So he called him Sak. So, and he looked inside the book and had instructions. There's a tunnel there. The Eightfold Path said, first of all, you've got to study the map. The right view. And number two, you've got to have the right motivation. Why are you getting it? Because if you don't do it properly, you get lost. And you've got to be very good. Right speech, right action, right livelihood. Because in those tunnels, there's snakes and there's rats. And if you're a bad person, they'll smell you. And they will just chase you back again. You have to be very good. And you have to have this right effort. Not too much, not too little. If you rush, put too much effort, you'll get stuck. If you don't put enough effort, you won't get anywhere. Just the right amount. And you've got to be really aware. So aware, because there's many tricks inside the tunnel. And you can very easily take the wrong path. But lastly, you have to be very calm and very still. Because if the prison guard Will hears you, then you'll be caught. So little by little. Mo, the prisoner, he crawled through the tunnel, following all the instructions. and he came to the last part, and he got stuck. And he remembered, what should I do? Ah, yes, now's the time to let go. So he relaxed and let go. And then he sped through all the rest of the tunnel, through the beautiful blisses of the jhanas, and out into freedom, outside. And as soon as he got outside the prison, he got a new name. He was no longer known as Moha. He was known as Hari. Harihant, the enlightened one. Harahat. Harihant. Okay, oh, crikey. I tried my hardest to make life interesting for you. So yes, of course there is a way out. So that's the way out. So, dear Ajahn Brahm, you said not to worry, fear about the future. How do we manage our future? Shouldn't we plan and act? What is it? Act our plans? Look, how many plans have you ever made which are a total waste of time? They never happened. I never ever thought in my wildest dreams that I'd become a monk and end up teaching you guys. How many of you, when you ever thought that, you'd come all the way from Indonesia, to listen to a Kuai Lo to teach you about Buddhism? It's impossible, isn't it? But that's what life actually is, a series of totally unplanned events. You can't plan these things. When you first became a Buddhist, did you ever think you'd be sitting here listening to a monk while you're holding a teddy bear? Weird, isn't it? But it works. So a lot of time, the future is just so uncertain, it's hardly worth planning it. Just wait till it comes and then plan. Because we plan, why do we plan so much? Because we're control freaks. We always want to keep control. We don't know how to let things go. Now, planning is part of being a control freak. You've got two options in life. You make plans, you don't make plans. Whether you make plans or you don't make plans, things go wrong anyway. The only difference is, if you make plans, things go wrong. If you don't make plans, things go wrong. But if you don't make plans, you enjoy yourself before it all goes wrong. So, you've got your choice there. Enjoy life before it goes wrong. Or don't enjoy life and it goes wrong anyway. And you find it goes wrong less when you don't make plans. Because then you can adapt to things. Instead of making all these plans of what you're supposed to be doing and how you're supposed to be doing it, feel this moment. What's happening now? What do you really need to do? That's one of the amazing things in meditation. You get this brainwashed into you. Stop having all these plans. What am I supposed to do next in meditation? Stage one, stage two, stage three. And when you got to stage three, then I've got to do this. Keep it in mind. Remember the plan. This is what I'm supposed to do. And then you get somewhere else, and you get somewhere else. And yeah, it doesn't work that way. You just let go of all plans, and the path happens. If there's no free will and everything is a result of cause and conditions, then does that mean that our life is already planned and we can't change the outcome anyway? Yeah, might as well just give up. So what are you doing? But it is planned that you would ask that question. And it is planned that you won't follow the answer. It is planned that you'll do stuff anyway. Is that true? It's consistent. Now what happens is the plans are always changing. You don't know how it's going to work out. I don't know, is any scientists here, mathematicians, chaos theory? They say that, just the weather, it's just cause and effect, it's just science. Just a bunch of atoms mostly just oxygen, a bit of nitrogen, a bit of oxygen, carbon dioxide, just whizzing around the planet Earth called our atmosphere. And it all just, goes according to, basically, it's just Newton's laws of motion. And just, pressure and velocity and heat. So we should be able to predict the weather. Just cause and effect. So in theory, you should be able to predict the weather, but it's just such on the edge. You probably heard that chaos theory. A butterfly who is flapping its wings. It's Hong Kong, wasn't it? They said it's Hong Kong's fault. No, I think it was in Japan, wasn't it? Or China, Peking or something. Where was the butterfly simile? Anyway, somewhere in Asia, a butterfly flaps its wing in some would say Hong Kong, and it causes a typhoon in Sydney. It's your fault. Those butterflies again causing chaos. So, but that is actually true, that's chaos theory. Yes, there's cause and effect, but it's balanced so fine that no one can do the compilations to know what's going to happen. The weather is so uncertain. 1 or 2 days you may be able to give some predictions, but more than that, and the slightest variations give these huge differences. So, in theory, yeah, you can predict it, but you can't. So, it's not planned, and you're part of it. So you can mess up those plans. So that makes life interesting. It's not really planned. But then it's not planned, it's in between. So there we go. So in the meantime, you think you're not doing anything, but you are. Because you're conditioned, brainwashed. And I'm trying to stop that brainwashing, or rather than just tweak it this way, tweak it that way. So in the end, you can actually feel what it's like when you don't plan things. When you're peaceful. When you don't complain. When your brain has nothing to do. No plans. No past. No problems to fix up. Nothing wrong. Imagine that, what it must be like. No more plans, nothing to do, nowhere to go. Finished. Everything perfect. Would you like that? No, you wouldn't. It's amazing. Some people, their life is going so well. No plans, no worries. You know what they do? They go listen to Korean soap operas, dramas. Give themselves something to worry about. If all their family's okay, nothing to worry about in their family, they go and make something else, something to worry about. I've noticed this even in Bodhidharma Monastery. Monastery over the road there. Sometimes everything's going nice and peaceful, and somebody, this is not very nice. So they make some drama. We are attached to dramas. If it's not a drama in your family, a drama in your monastery, a drama in your hospital, or if you can't find a drama in the usual places, you find it on TV. Anything to have a drama. Because people like dramas. Something to do. Something to aspire. Problems to work out. Something to make you feel that you count. That you're alive. That you are. We worry, therefore we are. If you don't worry, you disappear. Anyway, my understanding of right effort is putting effort towards increasing wholesome states and decreasing unwholesome states. Doesn't this involve striving and wanting? You try that. You try striving to get wholesome states. You know what you get? Stress. Is that stress a wholesome state? Disappointment? Frustration? We don't use willpower, striving. We use wisdom power. Not willpower, wisdom power. That, somebody alluded to that in talking to me. There was, I've been around a long time now. Actually, I'm always around. People ask me if I'm going to be around next week. I'm always around. I'm a round monk. Well-rounded. So if you ask me, are you going to be around next week? Of course, I was around last week. I'm around this week. I'm a very round monk. Oh, come on. That's why, you know my nickname? Because sometimes people say, no, how can we sort of address you formally? Out of respect. I say, it's HR. Not HH, not His Holiness. HR. His roundness. First of all. His roundness and Ajahn, his teacher. And so I decided, somebody here said this, and I thought it was a really, really good thing. Instead of the abbot, spiritual dictator, the most venerable, because I go to these conferences, and now they call you most venerable. There's no place to go other past most venerable, because you can't have more than the most venerable. If you're the most, that's it, finished. And they have like Mahatera. You've heard Mahatera before. Unless you've got 20 reigns or more, you're a Mahatera. But then I was a Mahatera years ago. I'm 44 reigns now, so what can that be? And I figured it out. So a Mahatera is 20 years as a monk. 30 years as a monk, you have one up. It's Megatera. So any monk is 30 or none, 30 years or more, is a Megatera. And if you're 40 years, what are you? What's after Maha, Mega? Giga, yes! Gigatera. Very close to Giggletera. Close enough. So anyway, the name was His Roundness, Gigatera, Ajahn, Donut. Yeah, Donut. And the reason why I like the name Donut is, now what is a donut anyway? First of all, it's round. Number two, it's very sweet, very delicious. But most important, it's holy. It's got a hole in it. That's a donut. Holy, sweet, and round. Oh, what's I talking about anyway? It's talking about pieces of... Oh, yeah, the effort. But no, if you try that, you find that the effort, the striving, it just gets you frustrated. The reason is because what it's doing, it doesn't create wholesome states. It just strengthens your sense of will and controlling. So the effort is the effort to renounce, to let go, to stop, to be, rather than to go somewhere. To be content rather than wanting something more. Happy to be here rather than always thinking we should be somewhere else. Understanding what perfection is. There's the bent, crooked, twisted trees in the forest rather than your ideas of what perfection should be. If you change all of those and have wisdom power, you find you don't need to self-improve. There is no self to improve. So what the heck are you wasting all this time for, trying to improve something which doesn't exist? So, after a while, something clicks in us, trying all this hard work, like just the Bodhisattva for 6 years before he sat under the Bodhi tree, trying everything, really putting effort in. And after a while, frustration. What it was doing was coming from the sense of self, me doing it, I'm going to get enlightened. Gave up the sense of self. Let go, disappeared, vanished. It's letting go, which is the key to the meditation. You sit there and just do nothing. literally. And then the mind becomes incredibly peaceful. Yes, you will go through tiredness. Yes, you will go through fear. Just for some of you haven't done that before. Letting go, doing nothing, learning how to be and not judge yourself and not look at progress. Ingress, going in, not on. And after a while you find, wow, everything which you aimed for, you know, through effort and struggle and striving, it just comes to you. When you stop chasing. Many of you know the chasing, the running after the donkey running after the carrot. I'll say that again later on during this retreat. Donkey never catches a carrot, for when the donkey stops, the carrot comes towards the donkey. Weird, but that's true. And this is how deep meditation, and with the deep meditation of peace and stillness, if you try to sit still for an hour, you won't be able to do it. You just let go, become peaceful, and enjoy every second of it. And 2 hours have gone past. Why did that happen? Fully awake, alert, really energized. It's one of the reasons why this path, first of all, is counterintuitive. So if you're going to achieve anything in life, you have to work for it. But here you find you don't. Total different path. Letting go. Making peace, being kind, being gentle with everything. The monsters in the Emperor's Palace, welcome monster, thank you for visiting me. Being a friend to every moment. Whatever you're experiencing is important. Don't judge it and get rid of it. Have you ever been judged? And people say, I don't want to talk to you, get out of here. That's like your mind. Always judging it. Oh. Slot on topic, get out of here. Thinking, get out of here. That just means you don't engage, you don't understand the nature of your mind, and it just gets worse. You let go. Just be. What could be simpler than that? And then you get peaceful. Could you get peaceful? You're not wasting energy, you get energized. You get powerful mindfulness, joy. Bliss. You don't need the senses. You go deep inside. You get the beautiful lights in the mind. Powerful, blissful. Having a wonderful time. Body vanishes. And wow. You just got outside of prison for the first time. Scary. But good fun. And you get a taste of freedom. What did you do? Nothing. You don't need to be an Olympic athlete. You don't even have this very strong will to be able to be enlightened. In fact, the people with a strong will, they usually just get frustrated. You can't use the will to defeat the will. Letting go. Peaceful. That is how it works. What is your best time of the day for meditation? I think many of you know the answer. What's the best time for meditation? What's the worst time for meditation? The best time for meditation is now. Now is always the best time for meditation. What's the worst time for meditation? Later. Oh, wow. Someone's stymied me. I don't know about this one. Emptiness. Whoever wrote this, enlightened, congratulations. You can come and sit up here. Please explain again what noble silence is and why it is important for ourselves and others. Thank you. That was noble silence. Noble silence. Thank you for that question, because now is a nice time. to start to encourage the noble silence. You know that sometimes what happens, you're getting nice and peaceful, really enjoying the silence, and somebody comes up and says, oh, yeah, what do you want to talk about? You know, how was it like in Hong Kong? You know, how can I do some retreats over there? And Indonesia, well, where do you come from in Indonesia? You know, do you have a retreat center? Shut up, I'm trying to meditate. But the trouble is, if you talk, then that's another one who's broken the noble silence. So instead, I think this is a common sign all over the world, the one finger sign. That's one, that's right, yeah, not the middle one. Not in this monastery or temple, that's rude. The one finger sign, if you find somebody who's talking, you don't really want to have the conversation. Silence. To remind people of silence. Now, if you do need to talk about something, you know, some problems in your meditation or in your room, or, you know, you see the cockroach, you know, has moved from the microwave, you know, to the wok, and you want to make sure it gets out of the wok quickly before it gets all covered in sort of rice or fried rice or whatever. So fried rice is okay, but not fried lice. Well, it's only four elements anyway. What's the problem? Just solid and stuff. But anyway, no, we've got to be careful. So if you do see something, you can actually say to someone, oh, there's a cockroach in there. Or, you know, if you see, this time of the year, you don't see snakes. But if you do see a snake, what do you do? Keep a noble silence. What am I going to do? Don't try and mime it. That is not noble silence. That's called stupid silence. So, noble silence doesn't mean you don't talk at all. If there's something to say, you know, like in a snake or cockroach, then say it. You know, there's a cockroach on your toast. Happened to me, actually I'm not here, they'll probably be coming tomorrow, they usually come. This couple, first year I was here, they got some of these biscuits, some Danish biscuits or something, and they covered them with butter or with some covering, and I'd already eaten mine, and Ajahn Chakra was with me at the time, he said, hey, the butter's moving. It had little worms in it. I'd already eaten mine. Because I really needed extra protein in those days. I was working with. I didn't take it. Okay, it's just only a few worms inside. Anyway, but so with noble silence, with something to say, say it. But we talk too much. So because of that, especially in the hall, outside the hall, these places should really be minimum sound zone. So if you really want, and again, tomorrow we'll be having interviews, so if you've got something to say, you can come out there in the interview rooms, or the interview place, and talk through something. Maybe just, you know, little places, because those people working in the kitchen, you've got to say things there, you know. That's, you know, have a bit of noise in there. And also means that, you know, if you need to say something to the managers, fine, over there. But in this place over here, please keep quiet. And the other place to keep quiet, please keep quiet in your cottages. Because, you know, people meditate there and they sleep there. So those are places you should really try, out of kindness, compassion, to keep quiet. And you should be able to do that. A burglar can come into a person's house and they don't hear the burglar at all. And a burglar can do that. A burglar can open that door and you wouldn't hear it. But you, bang, crash, boom, bang, crash. So please learn how to move silently in this hall here and around the walking meditation around the area. and in your cottages, please, if possible. That means if you want to have a chat to somebody, you know, just ask them, and you just, you know, go to, you know, the tea places or something. That's much better. The dining room. Okay. There's another Nobel silence we keep here. Have you ever noticed that when you're supposed to get up in the morning, there's no bells? When you have breakfast, this is like a gong, it's not really about now, gong, bang. In some retreats have bells all the time, every hour. Bell, sit down. Bell, get up. Bell, sit down again. Bell, do walking meditation. Bell, go out to your showers. Bell, go to sleep. Bell, get up in the morning. Oh, it drives you crazy. So this is no bell silence retreat. And it's so popular, it actually works. You get more meditation, more peace. So what happens when you have no bell silence? Some people actually do win the Nobel Peace Prize, known as deep meditation. Nobel Peace. Okay, with the five khandhas, what is the difference between experience and perception? Experience is just the experience, just the basic, and perception is how you interpret it. So, like, just talking about food, the experience of perception. Experience is just all the ingredients, and the perception is how it tastes afterwards. Why is it so hard in this life? Well, because you made it hard. Don't blame me. You decided to get reborn. You know, it's so easy. You know that because people are talking about soccer, because the World Cup and who won and who lost, and some people get so upset. And I remember when I used to play, I watched soccer. I would watch soccer in the stadiums in London. And I would look at that goalkeeper, that's hopeless. Even my old grandmother could save a ball better than that. And there's, you know, people, they got an open goal there and they kick it over the bar or something. You're just hopeless. And you get paid for this. Because when I was watching from a distance, it looked so easy. But when you had to do it yourself, it was impossible. You understood that sometimes when we judge others, we don't know how hard it is ourselves. And I say that of politicians. How hard it is to manage a country. How hard it is to manage a family or a monastery or a Buddhist society. A country, that's almost impossible. Can you only manage your own body, let alone something like that? So sometimes we have to learn how hard life is, how difficult it is. And then we are far less critical of others. And also far less critical of ourselves. This retreat center is not perfect. Pretty good. The food, people work so hard to try and do their very best. But we still, even no matter how hard we try, you still get cockroaches in the microwave. So hard. So don't be so critical. It's only one cockroach. So what happens? When we don't get so critical, it's not so hard anymore. It's just life. Oh, Christ. Oh, there's one question left. It's three in his, two in one. If I am sitting cross-legged on the floor and I think I can only I am okay with it, but I still feel numb on my leg not long afterwards. Am I really relaxed, or is it just my thinking? If your leg goes numb, wonderful, then you can't feel it. So anesthesia. So then you just meditate and just get nice deep meditation, don't have to worry about your leg. Look, that used to happen to me the first year I was meditating as a lay person. My leg would go to sleep. And like numb, And then I started thinking, because I didn't know too much about meditation or the body. I was a physicist, not a biologist. And I thought, the reason it goes numb, because I'm cutting off the blood supply. There must be some pressure. You know, because I'm cutting off the blood supply, if you don't have blood supply, it going through your legs long enough, you'll get gangrene. And if I keep going any longer, because it's already hurting, this is a sign, I'll get gangrene. I'll come out of my meditation, my leg will be black, and I would have to have it taken off. That is total fear, paranoia. And but I didn't know too much, but I thought after a while, oh, what the heck, I'm just going to carry on. And so I was carrying on there, didn't move at all, leg went numb, and then after a few minutes, the leg became unnumb again. It just, the body just, it's like calling its bluff. And after a while, it was fine. So don't worry so much, don't worry which is the problem. It doesn't really matter, you know, you've got a spare leg. You know, so one's enough. But anyway, it's not that at all. all it is just the blood being restricted to the nervous system or whatever. That's what it feels like. So it's not life-threatening. But you know, if that does happen to you, just get some more cushions, sit on a chair. You know, people get enlightened sitting on chairs. So don't think you have to sit on the floor. So it is mostly your thinking. When I sit on meditation, suddenly a question pops up in my mind. If I stop my meditation and start writing the question for you, do you also call this living right now in the present? No, because you've got to leave the question alone. You've got too many questions. How many questions do you have in your life? And how many times you have some peace? Leave the question until later on. So just leave it alone. If it's important, it'll come back again. So just carry on with the meditation and forget about the questions. It's just, restlessness. My mind voice is very loud and chattering a lot, struggling to shut down. How to calm it down, please? Now, over in the Thai forest tradition, they used to have like mantras. So when, in other words, you have said a word when you're watching your breath. So as you are breathing in, people say, Buddha, with the breath, Buddha. So when I first came to Australia, I tried that, getting the meditators breathing in, Buddha, breathing out, Buddha. Hopeless, never work at all. So I tried to be a bit more inventive. So I told them, close your eyes, as you breathe in, don't use the word Buddha Nento, chant the word, breathing in, shut, breathing out, up. Shut, with the in-breath, shut. And what happened? Everyone was laughing. They don't take it seriously. So we have all that commentary and all that inner speech. Remember that that is not the problem, that's a symptom. So it's like a lake. There's waves on the surface, that's the thoughts, that's the inner commentary. That's always trying to take notes. That's a symptom, it's not the cause. So find out what's underneath, you know, the surface of the lake. Why you got those thoughts? And it's always wanting something. So one of the reasons why, if you don't want to stop the thoughts, you don't want to continue them, take all the wanting away, and you just sit there and just watch them. That's restlessness. No, remember that simile. When I go traveling in an aircraft, I don't move at all. The aircraft moves, and I move 100% with it. So I don't feel any movement at all. When you have a restless mind. You call it a restless mind, which means you try and stop it. That's called restlessness. Imagine you have thoughts and you just stand back a little bit, just watch them. But you don't interfere with them, you don't try and stop them, you don't encourage them. You're always there with them, just when I'm on an aircraft, I don't tell the pilot, hurry up, I've got to get to Indonesia a little bit earlier, you know, to get to the hall in time for the talk. Can you please, you know, put your foot down, please, Mr. Pilot? Can you take a shortcut, please? Of course you can't do that. Nor can you say, oh, can you just go slower? Because, no, can you just go down a bit? Because I really want to see Borobudur, the Chandi of Borobudur, from the air. So would you mind just deviating a little bit, Mr. Pilot, and just going down in a few hundred feet or 100 meters, and then I can actually do, no, even better, in a big Dreamliner, just go 3 times round Borobudur Chandi, because that's what you're supposed to do out of respect. They lock me up. You can't do that. All you do is sit down there and just wait for things to happen. So, saying when you are restless mind, sit there. Whatever's in front of your mind right now is the most important thing in the whole world. Just care. Then, something strange happens. The thoughts don't get so important. Because you are content where you are, instead of trying to be somewhere else. Because you're not doing anything, trying to get rid of stuff. It's called letting things be. Letting restlessness be. It's not restlessness anymore. Letting sloth and torpor be. It's not sloth and torpor anymore. It's the object of your meditation. Right in front of you right now, and you care for it. Because you don't struggle. Because you don't want anything. Because you don't not want things, the mind calms down. It doesn't need all that restlessness anymore. Have you ever noticed that sometimes, I used to do this when I was a school teacher, come back home, turn the TV on, you know, anything, nothing on the TV. Go, there's only about 3 channels in those days. Go to the refrigerator, nothing to eat. And there's food falling out of the refrigerator. It's just restlessness. Always keeping you moving, going, wanting something more. Whatever you have, you want something more. Whatever you have, not good enough, want more. Your lovely wife, nah, want more. Another. People are crazy. I really can't understand why some people, you know, especially guys, Chinese guys, they've got one wife, they want a mistress. Isn't one wife enough suffering? You want two, you really are dumb. But anyway, they don't do that crazy stuff. And so in the end, anyway, we just learn how to be content. Big word, contentment. You don't need to be filthy rich to be content. You don't need to have lots and lots of stuff to be content. You don't need to have the best husband, the best wife in the world to be content. Contentment is looking at what you have and appreciating the wonderful qualities which you see right in front of you. It's a beautiful meditation center. So content, happy. All the wonderful work which went into this place. That's one of the wonderful things. This, I like saying this because it really makes me inspired. That part of the floor you're sitting on there, the brown part on this side, the night before we had the opening, the first meditation retreat here, the Easter retreat, doesn't matter how many times, oh no, it'll be finished, don't worry, you not believing my professional credentials? A good reason to not believe their credentials, because the night before the retreat was going to start, a big opening ceremony, this was just concrete. The people doing the bamboo floor, they all wouldn't come. Or they got upset and they left. And we were 9 o'clock at night. We're having a big sermon the following day. And this was not finished. So, what happens? It's not the 7th Cavalry like these have in the Westerns. It is the Sangha. The monks came to the rescue. And they did that. They finished off this all night. I think they finished about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. A big ceremony the next day. Isn't it wonderful? So you are sitting on a floor which was done by monks, middle of the night, to about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and all done just because of wonderful giving, sacrifice for you. And that's the floor you're sitting on now. It's amazing. Yeah, I say that because I get inspired as well. So all this stuff which we do, it's not the best. When you find out where it comes from, it's gorgeous, it's beautiful. So just like your wife, your husband, your parents, your kids, your monks, your nuns, we're not the best, but really good enough. You appreciate stuff. When you start to appreciate stuff, that is where you get beautiful happiness, peace, and then no restlessness anymore. Just so happy to be here. Looking at the wonderful, not the 2 bad bricks, the 998 good bricks. No work to do. Appreciation, love, peace, contentment. You're happy. That's where restlessness stops. And that's also where this talk stops. Okay, that's really good. So, are you going to do a translation now or tomorrow morning?
Yeah, probably another half hour.
Okay, I'll try and finish off earlier tomorrow out of kindness to you, translators. Okay, here we go. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Excellent. Okay. So, see you in the morning sometime. There's no bells, so when you wake up, you wake up. And even though we don't have any bells, I've never yet seen people miss breakfast. It's true. They know where that is. Sometimes they miss the talk, but. Okay.